Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Nun Aleph and Mun Aleph by the two dots. Mara says, "How yatom v'yatoma da'atu lekamei d'rova." We have orphans that come before Rova, male and female. Amaluhu Rova he'alu liyatom bishvil yatoma. Give additional monies to the yatom out of the estate, meaning that we're going to grant them, the executor of the estate will grant allocations, allowances to the yatomim. Inside of that, or embedded in that, they should give excess in order that they can take care of the yitomot, that they can give mizonot or take care of the yitomot. Amri le rabbanon le rova v'marhu de amar rabbanon zei de rav. Aren't you the one who said mikarkei below mimetal tolei that the entitlement of mizonot for the banot only comes out of real property, not from mitaltalim ben milizmone ben lektuba ben leparnasa? Whether that is for the payment of mizonot for the banot, whether that's for payment of the ktuba, whether that's the parnasah for the nidunya of the banot, that all comes out of karka, does not come out of mitaltalei. Amaluhu, ilu ratza shibcha l'sham misho milo yahavinen lei. Wouldn't we give excess money to the yitomim in order to have someone take care of them? If they wanted to hire a maidservant, if they wanted to hire someone to help with the cooking or help with the cleaning in the house, they certainly would give them excess money out of the estate. The executor would give them part of their allowance. He would give them that money in order to hire such an individual. So in this case, he says, Kosh Kein Hocha Di Katarte. Over here, you get a double benefit. First of all, it's his sister. And number two is, she's going to help out in the house. She's going to help make sure that the boys are taken care of. And therefore, she should be no worse than a shifcha in this instance. And we can, of course, allocate money. But the way he allocated the money was not directly to the banot. He did it derech the yitomim. And that was indicative of what he's trying to say, which is not directly to the banot. This isn't because of the din mizonot, but this is the din of the yitomim themselves, that the yitomim themselves are entitled to such services or such allowances. And because of that over here, why not get a double benefit, which is they'll get those services plus they'll be able to support their sisters and take care of their sisters. Tan Rabbanan, echad nechasim sheyesh lehem achrayut, ve'echad nechasim she'ein lehem achrayut. So whether you have real property or non-real property, it doesn't matter here. Motzin lemazon isha ulevanot divrei Rabbi. Rabbi says that from that part of the estate, we will take out mizonot, pay the woman to pay the almanah, and lebanot, and for the daughters. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar omer. Rabbi Shimon Elazar argues and says, Nechasim sheish lemachariyut. If you're talking about real property, which in general is karka, motziin lebanot min abanim. First of all, we take for the daughters from the sons. The sons are the true inheritors of the estate. They're the ones entitled to the estate. But one of the tnayei ketubah is that the banot get mizonot out of the estate. And therefore, we're going to take from the banim who are entitled to this yerusha, we're going to take money away from them and grant it to their sisters in order to support their sisters and to give them mizonot. Ulabanot, mina banot. And the same is true for the girls from the girls. As Rashi notes over here, we're talking about older girls who took control of the estate. We'll ensure that the younger girls get their same fair allocation from the older girls, and not that the older girls keep everything, but make sure that the younger girls are equally taken care of. And the same thing is the banim min abanim. Same thing with older boys who take control of the estate. We'll intervene in order to ensure that the younger boys get an equivalent allocation out of the estate. Olubanim mina banot benichasim mirubim, and we will give to the sons from the banot in the case of nichasim mirubim. Here, there's enough monies in the estate to provide mizonot for the banot as well as yerusha to the banim. So here, where maybe the banot are older, we will intervene in this case to ensure that yes, the banot get their mizonot, but any excess beyond that is given to the banim as yerusha. In a case where there's not sufficient monies in the estate to both support the girls with mizonot and give the banim yerusha, over there the chachamim were koveya, they were oker yerusha mina Torah, and they granted yerusha to the banot. The banot will get mizonot, And the banim are machzirim al ha-tachim. They have to go around and collect tzedakah. The Gemara talked about this in other places, which is mishum ziluta. We don't want the girls running around and collecting. We'd much rather have the boys running around and collecting. And therefore, in that instance, when there aren't sufficient monies, property in the estate, then we will grant the daughters the first rights, and they will get their mizonot. And if their mizonot are not satisfied, then all the monies will go to them, and the banim will have to find their own way. They won't get any yerusha. On the other hand, nechasim she'ein lehem achrayut, nechasim that are not real property, mutzin the banim mina banim, ulebanot mina banot. Of course, again, if there are older boys or older girls over here that take control of the estate, we will intervene to ensure that the younger boys or the younger girls also get their fair allocation. Ulebanim mina banot. And we will also take the banim if the banot took care of the estate or took control of the estate. Aval, lo lebanot mina banim. On the other hand, if the banim have control over the estate, we will not take for the banot. So over there you see, because they're metaltalim, that if the banim take control and that's the Yerusha, then the banot have no entitlement in that case to any of this because it is metaltalim. And in the reverse, where the girls take control of it, we will ensure that the banim get their Yerusha because the girls are really not entitled to the mizonot in this instance. All right, now, the afagav de kainalon holocha kirabi mi chaveru. Even though we generally have a klale apsak that tell us that whenever Rabbi argues on an individual, on a single tano, the locha is like Rabbi versus that tano, hocha locha ki Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Over here, the locha is like Rabbi Shimon Elazar and not like Rabbi. Doma rovo, hilchata mi kamar karke e, velo mi mitau tale. Because we have Rovo, who is already a batra in the Amoraim, and he told us the locha is that these items can only be collected out of real property. They cannot be collected out of metaltalim, out of movable items. Ben the ketubah, whether it's for collection of a ketubah. Ben the mizonei, whether it's for defeating or taking care of the mizonot. Ben the parnasah, whether it is for the dowry of the daughters. Those that have yet to be married off, after the passing of their father, that dowry comes out again out of the estate. But again, also only out of real property and not out of metaltalim. A lot of this has to do, partly what we discussed yesterday, which is people are only really someich in terms of coming to agreements or assuming that they're going to get paid is when there's real property. Real property doesn't move. It's where everybody in their day actually made their deposits. If you wanted to save money, you bought property. That was the way that you ensured that you had wealth, that you passed things down to your next generation. And so therefore, it was seen as the primary vehicle for getting value and for ensuring that people got paid out on the obligations that were there. With regards to metaltalim, first of all, they were far fewer. They're much harder to track, and people are not so mech on them. They do not rely on them. And for that reason, they're not subject to these types of liens. In addition to, we'll see later today that maybe there's unique aspects about things that have what's called kitzvah, things that have finite amounts or clear amounts to them versus things that are unlimited as to where we take or collect those items from. So Tosfot over here says that Rava seems to contradict himself over here because he says the locha is like Rabbi Yehuda, that when it comes to dowries and parnasah, that we grant the second daughter whatever he gave to the first daughter. So when he was alive, he granted a dowry to one of his daughters, and then he passed it away. And now we have other daughters that are going to get married. What type of dowry do we give them? Rabbi Yehuda says, look at the precedent that he set. And based on that precedent, we will give to them the way that he gave to the Rishonah. And similarly, over there, it would come out of any of the possessions of the estate, whatever it is that we can do in order to assess that value. So then he says, when does Rabbi say Parnasa or Nidunya is limited to being paid out of Kark or Metaltalim? That's below the amidne. That's where we don't know. He hasn't indicated to us what type of individual is he. Is he generous? Is he miserly? What type of gift or dowry would he give to his daughter? And over there that he holds like Rabbi Yehuda, Ushmuel be'amidne shedato shetigveh mimetaltalei. There we see that he already had a precedent where he gave karka, he gave metaltalim. He did this already. So Rabba's limitation or qualification over here that parnasa or dowry is only paid out of karka, that's only when we don't know better. We don't have any information as to what the father did. But if we have information from the father, then Rova says over there, halacha ki Rabbi Yehuda. And halacha ki Rabbi Yehuda means that we look at the father's precedent, and based on that precedent, we'll give to this daughter, whether it's from karka or whether it's from mitaltalim. And the smart over there seems to indicate or differentiate in that way. Now, Tosafot adds an additional item here that's important. We saw this on Memtet. I say that Tosafot mentions this numerous places in Shas. Here's another time that he mentions it, which is the Takanata Geonim, which is an era of Dizmanazeh, to Kulhu Gabe Mimitaltale. Everybody can collect out of Mitaltalim today. That is Ketubah, Mizonot, Mitakanat Geonim. From the Takana of the Geonim, you're allowed to collect out of Mitaltale. Uparnasan Nami. And dowries also. Anan Sade. We are witnesses to the fact, Shekol Bnei Adam, Rigalim Lassi Bnoteim Mimitaltale. Then people today marry off their daughters, and the dowry is given from Mitaltalim and not from Karka. So based on that, B'chashiv Kumo Amidnei, it would be the equivalent of assessing the father's will, because even though we don't know maybe this particular individual's will, but we know in general, people will give dowries to their daughters out of the Mitaltalim. If that's the case, then Pasuk Rava K'Rabbi Yehuda, and we would do the same. So what Tosafot does here is, look, the Ikar Takanat Gonim is that today Mitaltalim looked like Karka, therefore we're going to make liens on the Mitaltalim, just like the Karka. So that's true by Ketubah, which is the Iker part of their Takana, and Mizonot, which is a derivative. Tosafot says, well, Parnosa, by dowries, we don't have any indication of what the Gonim are saying. Tosafot says, we can extrapolate. We can extrapolate the Din, which is, number one, if we can assess the Dat of the father, we'll follow that. And number two is, we know that the Gonim already established for us this equivalence between Mitaltalim and Karka. So now that we know that people give Mitaltalim as their dowry, and that's really the Gumno Karka, we're going to just assume that that's what people do. And therefore, Parnosa dowries can be taken out of Mitaltalim as well, as if that's the will of the father. As if we have assessed the will of the father, and that would be his will, because that's what everybody does. And therefore, we're in Anan Sade at this point that that's the case. So Tosfot is expanding this view of the Gonim, that Mitaltalim look like Karka, to encompass more items. All three items that are mentioned here by Rova to be limited to Karka, he says can be granted out of Mitaltalim. All right, next Mishnah. Lo katov la ketubah. If there was no ketubah written, betula gova matayim. A betula is entitled to 200 zuz, va'amana maneh, and an amana is entitled to 100 zuz, mipnei shehu, tanai beitin. It doesn't have to be written. It's a tanai beitin that's automatic in a marriage, that this is the entitlement of the woman in a marriage. Kotov lo sadeh shaveh maneh, tachat matayim zuz. He wrote as an encumbrance to the ketubah, that this field that's worth 100 zuz, that will cover your ketubah, but the ketubah is worth 200 zuz. Velo kotov lo, and he did not enter into the ketubah the standard language that was established by Shimon ben Shatach, which is kol nechasim de'itli achrayin l'ktubateich, that my entire possessions, anything that I own, are encumbered to the ktubah. Chayav, doesn't matter. Still get that right. The woman still has a right of collection from all of his property and anything that he owns. Shehu t'nai beitin. Again, once again, this is a part of the t'nai beitin. And even if you don't write them in the ktubah, they're automatically assumed to be part and parcel of the ktubah. Tosafot over here spends time, we'll see it in the Gemara, but spends time trying to figure out what was the woman's role here. When he gave her a sadeh of 100 that was against her ketubah, 200, did the woman accept it? And then basically what we're assuming here is that she was mochelet, that she agreed to this. So therefore, even with her agreement and being mochel, it doesn't matter, and we override that, and we say that she's entitled to this, because it's a Tanai Beit Din, and she can't eliminate that Tanai Beit Din. Or do we say now, this is a case where she didn't understand or she didn't accept it. That's what he granted her. And even though, with regards to Karka, there's no Ona'ah, there's no overpricing of Karka, because it's all about the person, the place, and so on and so forth, so you can't establish a real price for land, because different people have different views. It's very subjective, whatever the value of the land is, what people are willing to pay. So maybe over here where he presents the land, even though it's 100 zuz, he can claim it's 200 zuz. So there's no ona'ah, but nevertheless, she still can have a right to collect from other properties, because in the end, when she monetizes it, it's only worth 100. So despite the fact that he gave that and supposedly was accepted as 200, she really wasn't mochelet on the money. She just accepted the property, but it still has to be monetized, and she has to get her money in the end. So maybe even in the face of that, we would still say that she's entitled to these rights. And the one case where the Rishonim discussed the possibility over here, where he makes an apotiki, where he makes it a directed lien. That property is directed towards the tuba. It's not a general lien on the property. In that case, maybe you could argue that only from that property can she collect, because he gave her such a directed lien and she has accepted it in that case. So that's the one case where the Rishonim discussed whether she can be mochelet and it works. But otherwise, in general, we're going to assume here that even if she was mochelet, she's still entitled to this because it is a tnei beit din. Lo katav la im tishtabai afarkineich ve'ot vineich lili into. If he doesn't add into the ktuba, if you're taken into captivity, I will redeem you and bring you back as a wife. Ubu kohenet, if he is a kohen and he marries a woman, hajineich lemididinateich, I will bring you back to Am Yisrael. Because over there he can't marry her after she is a shvuya, because of the chashash that she had bi'ah with someone else. And that's problematic, even if she was ones. Even if she was done against her will, it's still a problem for her to return to the kohen. So the only thing he guarantees her is that he'll redeem her and bring her back to Am Yisrael, but not that he'll take her back as a wife. Chayav, shehut tnai beit din. Again, obligation, because it's a tnai beit din. If he doesn't write it, it's automatically a part of marriage. Nishbeit, chayav liftota. If she is taken into captivity, he is obligated to redeem her. V'imamar hare gita ukdubata. If he says, you know what? Here's her bill of divorce. Here is the monies of her ktuba. V'tipata et atzma. And let her redeem herself. Eino rashai. He does not have that right. He doesn't have the right to get out of the obligation of redeeming her. Lakta. If she falls ill, something happens. Chayav l'raputa. He is obligated to take care of her medical bills to help get her healthy. And the assumption is that rifuah is the equivalent of mizonot. Just like mizonot are to keep the health of the individual and sustain the individual, so to rifuah is the same way. This is assuming, here it's seemingly from the word lakta, that she fell ill not because of something that she did, but some accident or some difficulty that befell her that was out of her control. And therefore, he's chayav l'raputa, just like he's chayav to present her mizonot. Amar hare gita uktubata. If he says, here's your get, here's your ktuba, terapet atzma, that she should heal herself, cure herself, rashai. In that case, he does have permission to do it. Now, the halacha and many of the Rishonim say this, that we do not encourage this, and it's improper to do such. And so we discourage that type of behavior. We're not even allow this type of behavior. But the key question is, why is the issue of pijon different than the issue of refuah? Why by pijon can he not just remove himself from the picture? And why by refuah can he remove himself from the picture? So Tosafot back, it was on the Shabbat daf on Mem Zayin Amud Bet, if you remember, it says, Pirkona tachat peirot, that her redemption was connected to peirot. Tosafot over there wondered if the woman can reject this benefit. Can't she say, listen, I don't want you to redeem me, but I don't want you taking my peirot. Does a woman have a right to opt out of it? Tosafot says, no, she does not have a right to opt out of it, even though she has a right by mizonot to opt out and say, I don't want mizonot and I'll keep my maseya dying. So Tosafot over there says, v'yesh li tein tam. Says, you have to explain why. Why is there a difference by pirkona? So Tosafot gives reasons over there. One of those reasons is, shlo titama ben avdet kochavim. So she shouldn't just be left in captivity. Our fear is, and one of the biggest fears is, that her ktuba will not suffice to redeem her, and then she's going to be stuck there. If he gives her a get and ktuba, she's going to be stuck. We don't want to leave a woman in captivity. Tosafot says over there, we don't allow that to happen, because we want the husband on the hook for the redemption no matter what. No matter what the price is, and no matter what the circumstance is. So she can't reject that benefit, because we want someone on the hook to ensure that she gets redeemed. So therefore, Tosafot says, based on that, he thinks that there shouldn't be. He gives other reasons, which are interesting, which is that pijon, hopefully never in a lifetime, but does not happen often. Peirot, it's the cumulative effect of all the peirot over the lifetime that he collects that would allow him to redeem her. So in a sense, even if she needs to be redeemed now, then he would pay more money than the peirot are worth because he knows that he has an entitlement to the peirot for the rest of his life. Or the fact that he's eating the peirot all along the way, he doesn't count so carefully about doing the pidyon. On the other hand, by mizonot, which is a day-to-day thing, which is that he's exchanging the maaseh yadayim for the mizonot every day, in that instance, one day you can opt in, one day you can opt out, meaning that there's a measurement, there's a quid pro quo with the maaseh yadayim versus the mizonot. That might also have impact here with regards to the obligation, which is, as soon as she's taken into captivity, the obligation devolves upon the husband. At that point, he can't get himself out of the obligation by simply handing her a get, because he's already obligated. And giving her a get's not going to help anything because his obligation is still there. On the other hand, by mizonot, and we'll say the same thing by refuah, since it's in a day-to-day obligation, then each day is a new obligation. If he gives a get, he terminates whatever it was before he's obligated on, but he terminates the new obligation for the new day. And therefore, giving the get will stop the process and allow him to get out of being obligated the next day. And so for that view, again, Tosafot gives something similar to that, the view that mizonot is more of a day-to-day thing versus the pidyon, which is a lifetime type of thing, then there's only one chiyuv there, and once he's chayav, he can't get out of it. On the other hand, by mizonot, where it's a day-to-day thing, he can cut off at some point and say, whatever was before that, I'm a chayav in. Whatever's afterwards, I'm not obligated in. All right, so Nigmar asks, Mani, who is the author of our Mishnah? Rabbi Meir, he. Must be Rabbi Meir. Damar, kol apochet lebetula mimataim, ude almana mimaneh, harizo bi'ilat zinut. The Meir says that anybody who is living with a betula and has not granted her 200 zuz, which she's entitled to, or an almana who is entitled to 100 zuz, that is bilat znut. And therefore, we will not allow you to be together with a woman if you diminish in any way the value of the ketubah. D. Rabbi Yehuda, if it's Rabbi Yehuda, hamar. Rabbi Yehuda already said, ratza, kotev le betula shtar shel mataim. He will write a shtar that contains within it 200 zuz. And then she can write a shover, she can write a receipt that says, I already got 100 of it. So she has a ktubah, but she gives a receipt that I got 100, and basically the equivalent of having a ktubah of 100. Same thing, he can write for an amanah, here's your 100 zuz. Again, she can write a receipt that she received half of it. So essentially, they have the value of the ktubah. And that is allowed according to Rabbi Yehuda. So it's interesting. Over here, she never received the money, and she's allowed to write a receipt that basically forgives him on that point. The Rabbeinu Tam asks this about ketubah in general, which is that ketubah and the lien on the property in the ketubah, a person there is obligating themselves in money that they don't have. How is it possible young people that get married don't have the amount of money that is there to pay the ketubah? And yet they're obligating themselves in the ketubah. So where is the lien on their property if they don't have the property that's there? And the property that comes in later is not going to become encumbered. If they have property that's already encumbered, and then they start trading and moving around, then we can move the encumbrance from the existing property to the new property. If they never had property, then everything that happens is after the fact, and he's obligating himself now when he doesn't have it, and later on you can't move the lien onto that property because he never had a lien on anything. So the Rabbeinu Tam says later on in the Masechta, that is because the individual, when he writes the ketubah, basically is declaring that he has the money. Even though he doesn't have the money, even though we know he doesn't have the money, his declaration of saying he has the money creates the encumbrance because that's his declaration. And that declaration is what creates the future encumbrance on properties that he brings in because when he wrote it, he's basically saying, I have it. Because if he didn't have it, he wouldn't be able to get married. So he basically says, Hodat Baldin, Kameidim, that when a person admits that they have something, it's equivalent having Meidim that he has property, and he has property. If he tells us he has property, he has property. And that's it. We're not going to question, we're not going to look into it too carefully, but that's how you advocate yourself here. So too over here. The woman can forgive, even though she never received the money, she can write that I got the money because they're basically trying to create a transaction in which she's forgiving a portion of the obligation of the husband, and she's allowed to do that. Oh, very good. So Tosafot asks your question, which is, it seems like, according to Rabbi Yehuda, you could think that he requires you to have a ketubah, a full ketubah, and then you can come up with an agreement that therefore gives a portion of the ketubah. What you can't do is start with a ketubah that is less than value, and then forgive it. And Tosfot discusses that within the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda, which seemingly he would agree on the basic premise that you need a real ketubah of 200 and a real ketubah of 100. Vim tomar umay kamar hamani Rabbi Meir. How could you say it's Rabbi Meir? Hamashma perkaf al pi. To the Rabbi Yehuda, nami inu yochol limchol tzedino batel. You can't put a tznai in the ketubah because your tznai will get wiped out. B'davka b'kutevet lo hitkabalti kamar. It's only when she writes a receipt against the ketubah that it works. So in that case, Rabbi Yehuda could be the author of our Mishnah, because our Mishnah is talking about a case where he reduced the amount in the ketubah, and even Rabbi Yehuda agrees with that. So he says, v'yishlamar, dehota mayri lefiya maskana d'shmaitin. He says that Gemara is based on the results or the end of our Gemara, which we'll see today, that the Gemara now will unwind this decision that it's only Rabbi Meir and said that the Mishnah could be Rabbi Yehuda. So he says the sugya later on, which establishes basically this premise of Rabbi Yehuda, is based on the maskana of the Gemara that Rabbi Yehuda would even be able to be the author of our Mishnah. But at this point, the Gemara is trying to establish that fact, and in this case, they don't know that about Rabbi Yehuda yet. So that Gemara is already based on the conclusion of our Gemara. Now our Gemara is trying to establish the facts that will become the basis for that Gemara later on. Now, interesting enough, Tosfot here discusses what happens if you make a condition in the ketubah, according to Rabbi Meir, that says that the tnai is, here we're married, based on the fact that we agree that you're only going to get 100 zuz. So Rabbi Meir says, Alma savar zitzano batel v'itla. Tnai is knocked off because you're not allowed to be married without it, so the tnai goes away, but she still gets it. V'kevan de'amar de'leitla lo samcha data. Bavi bilato biladznut. If that's the case, then she's not relying on the ketubah, and now you end up in a problem of biladznut. V'vi perishivan de'chol makom de'itla v'en isha betucha bo de'lo samcha data tiknu chachamim she bilato biladznut. That basically what the Chachamim established here is that any time that the woman feels uncertainty in the marriage, the Chachamim were magdir that as bilat znut. So in the case here where they have an agreement and they put a condition in the ketubah that she agrees to get married for less than the amount, Rabbi Meir says the tnai is batel. Well, if the tnai is batel, then she basically gets what Beit Din allocated to her. If Beit Din allocated to her 200 zuz, then they have a proper ketubah at this point in time because the condition is wiped out. So Tosfot says, then why is that called Bilat Znut? So the Rivan answers, that's called Bilat Znut because the woman herself now is uncertain as to whether she's going to collect the amount. The Tznai is wiped out, and now she only getting this as based on a Tznai Beit Din, and in her mind, it's not clear that she's getting the amount. She doesn't feel the security that she should feel in the marriage, and based on that insecurity, the Chachamim are magdir it as Bilat Znut, even though she will get it. In the end, she will get her 200 zuz, she will be entitled to that 200 zuz, and therefore, in a sense, the ketubah is not missing. Nevertheless, they're magdirit as bilat znut because of the insecurity of the woman. This goes back to what we spoke about on the first daf in the ketubot, this idea that the ketubah and the protection of the woman and the sanctity of the marriage, much of that has to do with creating a security for the woman and the woman feeling that she will be taken care of and she'll be okay in these situations. And that feeling is essential to the establishment of a proper marriage and a marriage that is infused with Kedusha. And you see that over here again with Rabbi Meir, that even though in the end she'll get what she's supposed to get, if she feels insecure, and that makes the marriage in some ways uneven or problematic, then we say that it's called Bilat Znut, and we're going to hold the husband accountable for creating an environment in which the woman feels insecure. He has to create an environment where the woman is secure, and she knows how she's going to get her ketubah, and she knows that she is safe, and even if something happens to her husband, she'll be okay. And that is the only way, or the premise, or the basis from which you can establish the sanctity of a marriage. Okay, now, Ema Seifa, what are you going to do with the latter half of the Mishnah? Kotav lo sadeh sheve maneh tachat 200 zuz. He gives her a sadeh that's worth 100 instead of the 200 zuz. Velo katav la kol nechasim deit li achrayim leketubateich. And he doesn't say, all of my possessions are encumbered to your ketubah. Chayav, shehutz nae beitin. He is obligated, no matter what, all of his property is encumbered, because that is a condition of beitin. Atan Rabbi Yehuda. That's according to the sheet of Rabbi Yehuda, damar achrayut to'ot soferhu. That when achrayut, encumberment is left out of a contract, Rabbi Yehuda says that's a mistake of the sofer, and it's automatic. Any contract that is written that doesn't show that there's a lien on the properties based on the sale or based on the ketubah, that was a mistake of the sofer, and we grant that right to whoever the individual is. That's basically what's happening in our Mishnah. Even though she wasn't granted a lien on all of his properties. Nevertheless, we're going to grant it to her. D. Rabbi Meir, if it's Rabbi Meir, Hamar Achrayut Lav Tot Soferhu. Rabbi Meir says, if you leave Achrayut, the guarantee, basically that whatever is in your contract will be fulfilled, and if it's not fulfilled, then you can come back and make claims against my estate or liens, and you will have first rights before anybody else who buys after you. Then Rabbi Meir said, that's fine. If you make a decision not to write that, that's fine. That's none. Matzah Shtarei Chov. If they find loan documents on the floor, you found a loan document. Im yesh bayan achrayut nechasim, if they have a lien built into them, they have basically a guarantee of payment. Lo yachzir, do not give it back to the creditor. Shebeitin nifraim mehen, because Beitin then will go and collect again with them, and you don't want that, because maybe it was dropped by the debtor, and the debtor had the contract, and now you're giving it back to the creditor, he's going to collect again. Ein bayan achrayut nechasim. On the other hand, if they do not have a lien in them, yachzir, then you can return it to the creditor. Shame Beit Din Nifrein behem, because Beit Din won't collect based on a contract like that. A contract without achrayut in it, Beit Din won't now and go make a collection. Divrei Rabbi Meir. So you see, Rabbi Meir differentiates between contracts that do have a lien built into them versus contracts that do not have a lien built in them. V'chachamim omrim, the assumption here is Rabbi Hudo is the Baal Plukta of Rabbi Meir. Echad zev, echad zev, doesn't matter whether the contract has the achrayut written in it or not. Lo yachzir, do not give it back to the creditor. Shebeit din nifrayin man, because Beit Din will collect from it. And Rashi points out, afilu haloveh modeh, shu chayav lo. Even if the loveh agrees that the loan is still outstanding and he owes the money to the creditor, we do not allow him to do that because we worry about collusion. We worry about the fact that the debtor is lying and say he owes the money, and he'll allow the creditor now to collect from encumbered property that was already bought by other parties. And then they'll split the difference afterwards. They'll split it between them. So we do not allow you to give it back, even when the debtor agrees that he is chayav. So in that case, we see that Rabbi Meir believes that achrayut nechasim, if it's left out, that's totally fine. Gemara says, now we're in a situation where Reisha Rabbi Meir, the Seifa Rabbi Yehuda. The beginning of the Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, and the Seifa is Rabbi Yehuda. V'chitei makula Rabbi Meir he. Oh, why don't you say that the whole thing is Rabbi Meir? V'shayni leila Rabbi Meir ben ketubah lishtarei. And Rabbi Meir will differentiate between a ketubah and other documents. It would make a lot of sense to make that differentiation, because other documents with regards to achrayut, over there, it's a decision of the parties. On the other hand, by ketubah, that was an imposition of Shem ben Shetach. It was the takana of Shem ben Shetach. Mar says, Umi Shanile, does Rabbi Meir readily differentiate? V'atanya, we have a brayta. Chamisha govin mina mechurarin. There are five people that have the right to collect from unencumbered property. That means that only if the property exists in the estate or the individual still owns the property can you collect your rights here. But if he's already sold the property or the property belongs to someone else, he will not be able to get that money because that's encumbered property and he won't be able to collect from it. So you can only collect from monies that are ready and available now. That's really real property that's available and unavailable. Ve'eluhein, these are the items. Peirot, v'shevach peirot, v'me'akabel alav lazon et bidn ishto bat ishto, v'get chov she'en ba achrayut, u ktubat isha she'en ba achrayut. All right, so we'll go through the latter two, which are really the ones that are relevant to us, which is a get chov she'en ba achrayut. The word get means a contract. Get, today, the common meaning, it's been lifted and used to mean a get as a bill of divorce. But the true meaning of the word get, and the Gemara uses it other places, is simply a document or contract between parties. So a get chov is a debt agreement between the parties. Shein ba'achrayut. This is Rabbi Meir, the shitato. That's how we know Rabbi Meir is the author of this braita, which is that when achrayut, the lien, is missing from a debt document, that's fine. The debt document is fine, and you can only collect now from unencumbered property. You'll only have rights to collect from free and clear property, property that hasn't been bought by other people, or other people don't have rights in it. Uktubat tisha shein ba'achrayut. And in that same group is a ketubat isha that doesn't have achrayut. Well, our Mishnah says if a ketubat isha doesn't have achrayut, it's automatically granted achrayut. It says as if it's written in there. Over here you have someone saying that when you have a ketubat isha that's missing achrayut, that's fine. Then the woman will only be able to collect out of free and clear property. She won't be able to then have a first right, a first lien on all the husband's property, and she can go collect from the kuchot, buyers who came after her, people came after her, because there was no achrayut in there. So here you have Rabbi Meir. This is basically what the Gemara is saying, is this is Rabbi Meir's shita about get chov. And you see over there that he doesn't differentiate between get chov and ktubat isha. The other three items, the reason that we do not, in this case, grant them rights to collect from the mechurarim, Rashi explains over here, with regards to a person who commits to sustain or pay for the mizonot of his stepson or his stepdaughter, over there, the fisha in kitzuvim. There is no fixed amount. Vein ktuvim, and it's not written down. On the other hand, a woman is granted the right to collect her mizonot, even though they're not a fixed amount, because she is classified like a creditor against the husband. So the woman or the widow of an estate has the rights of a creditor. And since she has the rights of a creditor, she can then collect her mizonot, even out of property that was bought after her, and she can collect, even after from the Yerusha, she can collect from the Yitomim, because she's granted that right or superpowers, like as if she's a creditor of the husband. On the other hand here, where they have a stepson and a stepdaughter, where number one, there's no fixed amount. Number two is it's not written down. Today, when you go buy a property, how do you know there's no encumberment or liens on the property? You go to the title company and you get it checked out and make sure that there's nothing that encumbers this property. In their day, they obviously did not have a title company. And so the way that people were able to know that there were liens on a property was, number one, if they were made public. How are they made public? Biktuvim, when they were written down. Things that were documented and done in a public manner, that was the way for people to understand that there were liens or there were creditors in these situations. In addition to that, if the debts or the encumbrance or liens are ktsuvim, are for a fixed amount, then these individuals can protect themselves. What they will do is purchase property from this individual, but leave residually behind enough property from which to collect this person's loans, this person's creditors can come in, or whatever obligations they have, you'll leave that behind. But if you don't know how much this individual is going to owe, then you can never protect yourself. And basically what you're going to end up doing now is locking down the market for sales, because people will be afraid to buy, because this person could be encumbered before you purchase the property in a manner that has no limit, and then they can come and take your property away from you. So then only in cases where it was written down and it's a fixed amount do we allow people to come and collect from encumbered property or property that was bought after the fact, because those purchasers can protect themselves and they can understand how to protect themselves. So now the cases here in this braita are, number one, peirot and shevach peirot. That deals with a case in which an individual stole a field. After stealing the field, he now sells it to a third party. That third party who thinks he owns the field, he purchased it, now invests a tremendous amount of money into that field. Now, when I find out that the guy was really a gazlan and that he had stole the property goes back to the original owner. For the gazlan, he's now got to repay this individual. In terms of the Karen, the principal amount that he paid for the property originally, that money he has a first lien on, because when he purchased the property, anybody who came after him knew that he purchased the property and that he had recourse. And therefore, they know to protect themselves. If they buy, they'll leave enough over to take care of him. Or if they don't, they know they're assuming the risk that if something happens to that first property, that person can come and collect from them. On the other hand, with regards to the investment that he did in the property and he raised the value of the property, as well as the peirot that derived from that property he didn't get a chance to eat, which the gazlan does owe him money for, those will only come out of unencumbered properties, because there is no way that these people who bought after him could protect themselves from such a claim. They don't know how much he invested. That can make it endless. It can make it impossible for them ever to protect themselves. And then people will be reluctant to purchase because they'll never know how to protect themselves, or they'll never know whether the previous buyers are now going to impinge on their rights, because they'll now invest a lot of money in the property and then they'll never be safe, the subsequent buyers. So in order to keep that clean, we say that the purchase price of the property, that can come out of Mishubadim. On the other hand, anything in excess of that, that the gazlan now owes to the party that he sold, the third party that he sold the property to, that will only come out of Mechurarin. That will only come out of free and clear property. The same is true with regards to a Mekabel Alav Zonet Bin Ishto Bat Ishto. An individual who accepts to support his stepdaughter or his stepson, in that case as well, Mizonot, or something that is not katsuv, it's not a fixed amount. And it is also not documented so that buyers subsequent to that time would even know that this person has these obligations outstanding. And therefore, purchasers of the property don't know how to protect themselves against some condition like that. Therefore, we said they can only collect out of the free and clear property, not out of the encumbered property. It's something where they don't have a lien. They aren't considered to be creditors of this individual. And therefore, they can only claim or make claims out of free and clear property. As opposed to that, which we said before, Rashi notes that the almanah is considered to be like a creditor. And since she's classified like a creditor, she does have better rights than these individuals, and she can collect out of encumbered property, because everybody knows that the woman or the wife of such an individual has those rights to collect, and they know that they can protect themselves or leave over what they think is sufficient money or property after them in order to protect themselves when they purchase. So the Gemara continues, Man shmaile damar achrayut lav taut soferhu. Who's the one who told us when achrayut, when the recourse is left out of the contract, that is not a mistake, and that can be a fine contract? Rabbi Meir, Viktani. And that same braita that says, first of all, leaving out achrayut is totally fine, also says Ketubat Isha, mentions that Ketubat Isha can have a lack of recourse, and that'll be totally fine. That even though these individuals have no liens and no recourse, they still can have a valid ketubah. So you see here that Rabbi Meir clearly is the author of the braita, as well as he does not differentiate between regular debt documents and a ketubat isha. Ibai Deima Rabbi Yehuda, Ibai Deima Rabbi Meir. So some say the authorship of this is Rabbi Meir, and some say that the authorship is Rabbi Yehuda. Ibai Deima Rabbi Yehuda, some say that the authorship here is attributed to Rabbi Yehuda. Hatam katavla hitkabauti. Hachalokat vale hitkabauti. And that's what Tosafot said. Here the Gemara tells you there's a difference. Rabbi Yehuda agrees that you can diminish the amount of the ketubah, but not by directly impinging on the ketubah itself, but only by writing a receipt against it. And that's what Tosafot says. The Gemara later on is based on this conclusion over here that Rabbi Yehuda can be the author of our Mishnah, because he agrees you can't ruin the ketubah. You can't change the amount in the ketubah. You can only do it, or you can impinge on it by creating a receipt. Ibai is Rabbi Meir, and some say that it's Rabbi Meir is the author of our Mishnah. Machayav diktani mina mechurarin. When it says in the Mishnah, he's chayav, doesn't mean that he's chayav, and therefore she's granted rights to collect from anything. He's chayav to pay the full 200 zuz. If it's encumbered property, she won't be able to get it. She can collect from the free and clear property. Even though he gave her a specific field as payment for a ketubah, she still has a right to the full 200 zuz, as long as she doesn't have to go and get it from encumbered property. But if she gets it from him, that's fine. She has a right to collect that full 200. Okay, lo katavla. If he didn't write it. Amar avua de Shmuel. Eshet Yisrael shenenasa asura lebala. In a case where an Eshet Yisrael was raped, she cannot return to her husband. Chashinan shema tchilata beones v'sofa beratzon. That she started out as an ones, but in the end, she gave in, whether it's to her yetzer or because she wanted in the end. We say that once she gives in, she's not allowed to return to her husband. Eteve rav lavua de Shmuel. Rav now challenges Shmuel's father. Our Mishnah says one of the guarantees of the ketubah is that if you're taken in captivity, I will redeem you and bring you back as a wife. And certainly over there, what's the problem? Is that she was nanas. The reason that we force him to bring her back as a wife is because she was taken against her will, and she had bi'ah against her will, and therefore she's entitled to come back to her husband. Ishtik, he had no answer. Kari Rav Alei Davud Shmuel, Rav said this pasuk about Davud Shmuel, Sarim Atzru V'milim, V'kaf Yasimu L'piem. The ministers, the princes, were speechless, right? V'kaf Yasimu L'piem, and their hand is over their mouth, that they didn't know what to say. Ma'it L'le Meimar. Now Rav's saying that because there was something to say, and yet Davud Shmuel didn't answer it, meaning that he was silenced, even though he shouldn't have been silent. Bishvuya, hey kilu. The difference is, by shvuya, we are mekil. Because by shvuya, it's only a chashash. So by shvuya, we're mekil, and we let her come back to her husband. But in a case of me'anes, when we know for sure there was bi'ah, maybe there would be a difference there. Maybe the outcome would be different. And that's the way Avuah Shmuel could have answered, that the mission is not a proof against his position. Ula Avuah Shmuel, ones, desharia rachmana, echa mishkachala. The case of rape, where the Torah permits the woman to return to her husband, what is that case according to Avuah Shmuel? Avuah Shmuel says we're always worried about the fact that she maybe in the end gave in. In the end, she maybe was a willing participant. So going to Amrei Edim, shetzavcha mitchila v'ad sof. In a case where she screams from beginning to end, where she's trying to get out of it. She's screaming for help the whole time. But it's very clear that it was against her will for the entire period. That's according to Avod Shmuel. Uplige de Rava. Avod Shmuel argues on the position of Rava. Dama Rava. Kol shetchilata be'ones v'sof biratzon. Anything that begins as an ones and ends biratzon, afilu hi omeret hanichulo. Even if she explicitly says, leave him be, let him go, shil malei niskakla hisuchato, that had he proposed to her, she would have hired him, muteret, she's allowed to return to her husband. Meaning that even if she articulates in the end that she's very happy with this, but because it started out as a rape, we say in the end, my taima, yetzer albusha, that she was captured by her yetzer. Since she was captured by her yetzer, she acquiesces in the end, even though it started out with force. So Rava says there's no evidence from the fact that she seems like a willing participant in the end. But because it started out against her will, once she gives in, that's not a raya that she really wanted this. It's only because she was then captured by her yetzer. She was overcome by desire. And that's what led her become a willing participant. But because it started, whatever started with it, or how it started, will dictate how we view this. And since it started as a rape, it will remain as considered a rape, even though it seemingly she was a participant in the end. Tanya Kavoti de Rava, we have a break that supports Rava's contention here. V'hi lo nitpasa, the case where the woman wasn't grabbed, she wasn't forced. So now Gemara says, v'hi lo nitpasa asura. In a case where she wasn't forced, then asura, she may not return to her husband because she was forced in that case. Lo nitpasa asura. If she wasn't forced, then she's asura. If she was forced, then she is muteret. Ha nitpasa. If she was forced, then she's muteret, because that's a case of rape. Ve'yesh lecha acheret. They're dashing out the word he. He is a miut. There's another woman. Sha'afo pishlo nitpasa. Even though she wasn't forced, muteret. She's still allowed to return to her husband. Ve'zozo. Which is that case where a woman who is not forced is still allowed to return to her husband. Koshet chilata be'ones v'sofa biratzon. Case where it started as a rape, and then she gave in the end, and became a willing participant in the end, in that instance, it's still muteret to come back to her husband, and that's supportive of what Rava just said. Tani idach, we have another braita. V'hi lo nitpasa asura. If she was not forced, then she can't return to her husband. Ha nitpasa muteret. If she was forced, she's allowed to return to her husband. V'yesh lecha acheret she'afu pish nitpasa asura. And there's another woman, even though she was forced, she's still asur to return to her husband. Ve'ezozo, what's that case? Eshet Kohen, the wife of a Kohen. Because the wife of a Kohen can't return because the Kohen can't be together with a Zonah. And any other man's bia with his wife, even against her will, makes her into a Zonah or classifies her as a Zonah. And therefore she can't return to her husband, the Kohen. Irrespective if she was a willing or unwilling participant. Amar Rav Yehuda Mashmuel, Mishum Rabbi Yishmael. V'hi lo nitpasa asura. If she was not forced, then she cannot return to her husband. Hanit pasa muteret. If she was forced, she can return to her husband. Beishla acheret she'afu pishlo nitpasa muteret. And there's another woman, even though she wasn't forced, that is allowed to return to her husband. Ve'zozo, what's that case? She kidushea kidushei ta'ut. There was some condition built into the kidushin, and that condition failed to be taken care of. And the failure to take care of that condition, it unwound the kiddushin retroactively. So she was never married to this man. So when she had the extramarital affair, even though it was a willing affair, she's not a surah to this husband because she was never married to him. She's having this affair when she's really a single woman. Afilu b'na murkava k'teifa. Even if she has her son riding on her shoulders, mima enetz v'olechela, she can say hasta la vista to her husband and leave. She's never married to him. So whatever affair she had as a single woman. And affairs as a single woman doesn't make her to asura to anyone, except possibly to a kohen if she's classified like a zonah. But otherwise, she's muteret. So even to the man she was supposedly married to, she can go back and now get married to him for real, because her marriage to him was unwound retroactively. So she was never married to him. So she still chooses to go back to him, even though it looks like they're living as husband and wife. And then she has this extramarital affair, but since there was a condition in the kiddushim that now failed to be carried out, it's as if they were never married. Since they were never married, this is not considered an extramarital affair. If there's no extramarital affair, she can return to quote-unquote her original husband, who she was married to until the kiddushim got unwound. because she didn't have an extramarital affair. It'll be like them getting married for the first time now. And since it's like that, it's muteret. And again, this could happen even if she has children already. Even if she's been married for a long duration, if there was some condition built into the kedushin that fails, then the kedushin are unwound retroactively, and she's not a married woman. All right, so that you have to deal with, which is that in general, we believe nisuin override. All conditions are forgiven at the point of nisuin. So then you have to discuss why over here that's not the case. And in general, we believe that chibat nisuin overrides any conditions. And the chibat beyond, the chibat nisuin, says at that point in time, everybody's accepted what's happened, and all conditions drop away. There is no tanaim in the nisuin. So what you have to say here is, it's actually a machloket as to whether a tanai can survive the nisuin or not. Obviously, this is according to those that think that a tanai can survive the nisuin. So Amar Rav Yehuda, Hananashay Dganvu Ganve, these women that were taken into captivity by these marauders, these thieves, Shayin the Guvrayu, they can return to their husbands. The assumption being that there's no reason for them to give in to these Ganavim. They're stealing these people's wives from under their husbands. But even though they now have Biyah with these women, the assumption is that it's done against their will. Since it's against their will, they can return to their husbands because they were not willing participants. Amrilei Rabbanan Rabbi Yehuda v'haka mimitain lehu nehema. Wait a minute, don't these women then provide food and bread for these thieves? They're supporting them, they're bringing them his own oath. It says, Machmadira. They're afraid. They're in captivity. They're afraid for their lives. So they do whatever they tell them to do. They tell them to give us food, they give them food. V'haka mishachan lehu gire. Wait, don't they provide them their weapons when they're out there fighting a battle and they're in a skirmish of some sort? The woman becomes the arrow carrier, the weapons carrier for them, and they provide them their weapons, and they hand them their weapons. Mar says again, Machmanira, that's out of fear. He tells her she's got to do this. She listens, because otherwise they're going to kill her. De'ishavkinu, va'azlami nafshayu asiran. But if the ganavim release them and say you can go wherever you want, and they still remain with the ganavim, in that case they're clearly asirim to return their husbands, because now they are willingly staying with these men, and since they're willing to stay with their men, they may never return to their husbands because it's no longer because of fear, it's no longer because of force. Tan Rabbanan, Shvuye Machot Arayen Ki Shvuyin. Those that are taken captive by the king have a din like regular captives. Ginuve Listot Enan Ki Shvuyin. Those that are taken by these marauders or these thieves are not like captives, and therefore we assume that they are willing participants. So in the case of the king, they can return to their husbands. In the case of the marauders, they cannot. Don't we have a bright that says just the opposite? Which is that by malchut, they cannot return to their husbands. And by listim, they can return to their husbands. How do we reconcile this? Malchut on malchut lo kasha. Kingdom on kingdom is not a kasha. Haba malchut chashverosh. By the malchut of chashverosh, those women were all taken against their will. And the assumption is that they were not going to be taken as the queen. They're unlikely to be taken as the queen because there were so many participants, so they don't assume that they are going to be the queen, and so they only are taken unwillingly. They don't willingly give in. In addition, given that Achashverosh is such a powerful king, they don't only have a choice in the matter. It's against their will, and no matter how much they scream or reject this, they're not going to be set free. They're going to have to be subjected to the king's harem. Haba Machu Benetzer. This is what the kingdom of Benetzer. Benetzer was a marauder, a thief, and basically he sets up a kingdom. He becomes the king of the thieves, and he sends up a small dominion over this area. And over there, this woman thinks, basically, she has a chance of being the queen, because he's not such a big guy. He's not a big deal. And when he took her, she thinks she's going to be the queen. So she might give in willingly, because she thinks, look, I'm married to the king now. I'm married to the head now. Listit alistot lokashin. Same thing with marauders. Haba Benetzer, haba listim d'alma. Generally, with listim, the woman does not give in because she doesn't assume she's going to get any benefit out of giving in over here. There's nothing important about this guy. On the other hand, Benetzer, when we're talking about him, oh yeah, that guy, for sure, over there, she has a chance of being the queen, so she will give in willingly. Gemara says, Benetzer, hatam kari le melech, v'hacha kari le listim. In one place, you're calling him a king, and one place, you're calling him a marauder. He says, in, yes. Gabe Chashverosh, listimu. Vis-a-vis the kingdom of Chashverosh, who's a real king and dominion over a large tract, Madai, Paras, 120 Medinot, then yes, then Netzer is a small fry. So he's called the listim over there. Gabe listim da'alma melechu. But vis-a-vis other listim, he would be considered a king, because he's the head of the listim. He holds a large tract of land. So vis-a-vis a normal king, he's a marauder, a robber. He holds like a small little kingdom over there. But on the other hand, vis-a-vis other listim, then he would be considered a king. So in one bright, I called him a king, and one bright, I called him a listim. And again, in both cases, by Ben Netzer, we worry about the woman giving in willingly because she thinks she has a chance at being the queen, at being married to Ben Netzer and being his wife and benefiting from that. In cases where they think there's no benefit or they have no chance of being the queen, we don't assume the woman gives in willingly. That's by the case of Achashverosh, where there's a low chance of being the queen. And that's by the case of regular listim, where there's no benefit to the woman to being the wife of this thief, because he's just a regular thief. He doesn't rule over anybody. Here, Tosafot asks about Esther. He says, wait, what about the fact that the Gemara Megillah says that Esther was married to Mordechai, and then she went to Achashverosh, and then returned to Mordechai, and over there she was the queen. So it seems like she would have given in willingly. If she was willingly giving in to the queen, then she can't return to Mordechai. And yet over there, the Gemara says that she went to the mikveh and returned to Mordechai each day. Again, Tosafot's very interesting over here, as well as in the Gemara Megillah, I pointed this out, takes the Agadata very literally, and then he starts asking halachic questions on it. So over here, he has a halachic question on it. He says, "En lach showed me Esther, David Shari el Mordechai, that she was able to return to Mordechai. The tzadeket gemura haita. She was unusual. She was tzadeket. So we can't bring raya from her. She was different than a regular woman. So don't bring a raya from there." So even though he's taking the Agadata literally, he says that she's exempt from that because she's a tzadeket. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots at the bottom of Nuf Aleph Amud Bet.